Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today we are honored to have with us Brian Cuban, author of an important book titled The Addicted Lawyer, Tales of the Bar, Booze, Blow, and Redemption. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for writing this book. Brian, let's go right to the heart of the matter. How and why did you become an addicted lawyer?
Oh, there are quite a few reasons. I don't want to say there's any one specific thing that I can point to, but going back to my childhood, there was a lot of trauma. There was fat shaming, bullying, and combined with my personality, it really set me into a tailspin where I developed an eating disorder as a freshman in college, anorexia. I transitioned to bulimia. And then by my sophomore year in college, I was a problem drinker, quote unquote, alcoholic. Then I discovered cocaine and also dealing with clinical depression. So there were all kinds of things that led me into addiction. So I don't want to, there's a difference between cause and correlation. So I don't want to say there's any one thing, but it all kind of snowballed to the point of my becoming suicidal in the summer of 2005, my first of two trips to a psychiatric facility. And then finally in April of 2007, in my second, part of my second trip to the facility, I really, at that point, I realized that there probably wouldn't be a third trip, I'd be dead. And that was really my quote-unquote aha moment where I began my recovery.
Got it.
Looking back at that journey, I saw a lot of – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, given all of that, was the legal profession the right way for you to go?
Well, I hate to engage in what I call revisionist recovery. In a perfect world, it probably wasn't the perfect choice if I could turn back the clock, because I never really wanted to be a lawyer. It's, for me, going to law school was more, I saw the opportunity where I could spend three more years where I could repeat cycles and kind of survive versus having to go out in the real world and deal with all of my mental health issues at that time. So I never had this grand vision of being a lawyer. I was actually a criminal justice major, and I wanted to be a police officer, which wouldn't have worked out too well either.
Well, as you point out in the book, the legal profession has a disproportionately high level of not only substance abuse, but also anxiety and depression. Why is that?
There are a lot of reasons. One of the ones that I try to focus on when I speak at law schools and speak to lawyers is that as a profession, we tend to be people who are not willing to allow ourselves to feel the things we need to feel to explore the things we've been through in life that may trigger depression, that may trigger problem drinking, that may trigger drug use. We have a hard time allowing ourselves to be vulnerable. Lawyers are no different than anyone else. We bring all the baggage of our childhood, all the baggage of trauma that we have gone through to the office, to the courtroom. But we may be people who tend to compartmentalize those issues and say, I've dealt with it. So we don't really heal. And then those issues are just waiting at the surface, bubbling to be triggered by stress, by things going on in the office, by things going on in the courtroom, by social isolation. Most lawyers are solo practitioner or small firm, so they may be socially isolated. And we have all these things that can trigger mental health issues, but there are things as a profession we tend not to want to deal with. We're trained to take advantage of vulnerability, not explore our own.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Brian Cuban about his book titled The Addicted Lawyer, Tales of the Bar, Booze, Blow, and Redemption. Now, Brian, several moments ago, you mentioned that as a kid, you were bullied. The skeptic might just say, hey, that was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Get over it. What's your response?
The data would contradict the skeptics. I mean, there's tons of data out there that things like bullying and different types of childhood trauma affect people for life if they don't deal with it. Not will it affect everyone that way? No, but the people who usually respond that way are the ones who don't understand data, who don't understand the difference between cause and correlation. They'll say, well, my dad taught me to just pull it up by the bootstraps and look how I turned out. Good for you, right? But that's not how everyone is.
Understand. Now, you also mentioned that you suffered from anorexia and then you transitioned to bulimia. How common are eating disorders among males?
About 25% of those suffering from eating disorders are male, and about 1 in 10 will seek treatment.
And did you understand what was going through or what you were going through when you were going through the depths of anorexia and bulimia?
No, I had no clue. This was back in these issues began back in the late 70s and early 80s when I was a freshman at Penn State. And at that time, we weren't talking about eating disorders for females, let alone males. So I had no clue what an eating disorder was. There was no public discussion. It was obviously prior to the advent of the internet. So no, I didn't know. But what I felt at that time was that thinness was the way to body acceptance and social acceptance. Because in my mind, when I was in high school and I was a very shy child, I was a very shy teenager, all the kids that were getting the dates, going to the prom, holding hands, getting the first kiss, in my mind, they were all thin or muscular and good looking and pretty. So,
all right.
To an 18-year-old kid, that was the route to take.
Sure, sure. Now, when you got into law school, was there anyone you could confide in about your eating disorder or about your growing substance abuse?
I'm sure. Well, at that point, it was bulimia and exercise, bulimia and the drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure there were, but again, I felt very isolated, and this was a different time than it is now. We didn't have the openness about drinking and substance use that we have now. But so I didn't feel there was. There were no resources I was aware of in the law school. At that time, really, you were either in 12-step, which the people know that for people who don't know, the most well-known 12-step for alcohol is Alcoholics Anonymous. You were either in 12-step or you were in a hospital or you weren't in recovery. So we did not have the resources and the openness we have today. So I did not feel there was anyone I could go to. And I really didn't have the self-awareness that I would need to go to anyone in the first place. I didn't think I had a problem. To me, it was surviving.
Okay. Now, you referred to the climate of openness and resources that we currently have. Should a law student with a substance abuse problem feel comfortable going to a dean, going to a faculty member? And what about the bar exam? What about the character and fitness portion of most bar exams?
Sure, that is a lot of law students are hesitant to seek help exactly because of that. They don't want to have to disclose that they've received treatment, that they've gone through anything on the character and fitness. And states or different jurisdictions are beginning to change how they ask these questions so as not to stigmatize students and so they feel comfortable in answering questions honestly. But that's a concern, sure. And what I tell law students is, look, I understand the issue. I understand. No, I don't know any law student who has been prevented from taking the bar exam because of they disclosed a mental health issue. Do I know law students who have had to jump through some extra hoops in getting their license? Yes, people tend to confuse that. You're not going to be prohibited from taking the bar because you've disclosed a mental health issue. The issue comes when you get your license, before you get your license. So do I know law students who have had to jump through some extra hoops? Sure. But I try to get law students to look at the big picture. These things are progressive. They don't get any better. What I see quite often is law students who kick the can down the road, or they lie, which can bring up all kinds of problems later on if it comes out. Then you really are in trouble because that's conduct. You've lied on your character and fitness exam. These things are only going to get worse. They don't get better. And why wait for the consequences to catch up to the problem? Deal with it now. And then, you know, and then you can have a clean slate going down the road. You're in recovery, you're getting treatment, and you will be a better prepared lawyer for doing that.
Well, along those lines, in the book, you use several times the term high-functioning alcoholic. What exactly do you mean by that in the context of the legal profession?
Actually, I believe that I use the term for high-functioning lawyer.
Okay,
what I mean by that is lawyers who may be struggling with an alcohol issue or with a drug issue may look at themselves and say, you know what? I'm high functioning. I'm getting my work done. There's no reason for me to do anything because I'm making my caseload. I'm generating billings. I just had a good trial result. What I try to get people to understand is there's really no such thing as a high functioning lawyer. I ask them, well, how's your life at home? Well, it sucks. How's your relationship with your kids? Well, it sucks. And you really start digging, and it's not so high functioning. And what really happens is what I call the Peter principle of recovery. Lawyers
what do you
tend
mean by that?
To keep, well, the Peter principle is we work up to the level of our incompetence. So what lawyers do, redefining their level of high functioning, as it keeps dropping and dropping and dropping because of drug or alcohol use or depression or anxiety. So they can keep telling that everything is fine. But other people may start to notice, and eventually it drops off a cliff where all of a sudden they've done something and there's conduct, there's malpractice, or even worse, there's something where there are criminal consequences. The goal should be not to redefine our level of high functioning, but to try to recover at the highest level of functioning.
You alluded to AA and the 12-step program several moments ago. You have some very definite opinions about AA and the 12-step program. Would you share those with our listeners?
Regarding alcohol 12-step, sure.
Yeah.
I think I got sober in alcohol-focused 12-step. And so for me, it was great, but I think it's just one of many options. And I think that the legal profession, and this is something that I get pushed back on, is much too focused on alcohol-focused 12-step, AA being the most well-known, because that's what most of us have gone through. So when we're talking to other lawyers who may be struggling, I see the implicit bias where we tend to push people towards that, even though it may not be the right fit for a particular person.
All right. Final question for you, Brian. What, as a profession, can we do to make law schools healthier and the practice of law healthier?
As a profession, we should be encouraging law students and lawyers to allow themselves to explore what they've been through in life, provide a safe access, provide a safe outlet without consequences if there have been no conduct. We have to break the stigma. And so, and lawyers are starting, and law firms are starting to do that. Law schools are starting to do that. Deans of students of law schools are now very in tune with what's available in terms of resources and what it means with the character and fitness. Back in my day at Pitt Law, we didn't have a dean of students. So we really didn't have those funnels to mental health resources. Law firms, now we have the American Bar Association Wellbeing Pledge that lawyers are starting to, that law firms are starting to sign on. I just saw a law firm, I'm not going to name it, but I just saw a law firm advertising for a director of well-being. So we are making progress, but we also have a lot of lawyers and we have people at law firms who are just stuck in the past, and that you just pull yourself out of it, dig yourself out of it. If you don't like, if you can't maintain your mental health, get out of the profession. And so we have the old guard as well. So it, we have to change it one person at a time, one lawyer at a time, one law student at a time, one law firm at a time.
All right. Well, that will have to be the last word. Thank you so much for this compelling and really inspirational book. We've been talking with Brian Cuban, the author of The Addicted Lawyer, Tales of the Bar, Booze, Blow, and Redemption. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. You've been listening to Author Chats. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere.